Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. This week, we're pulling another episode from the long, long ago. My guest is Jessica Hinkson, an actor and filmmaker you may have seen as Dr. Ilsa Brundel in Another Wolf Cop, or co-starring opposite Jessica Greco in the short film Jessica Jessica, which they also produced. Her short film Joey was supposed to premiere at the Canadian Film Fest last month, but obviously that didn't happen. You'll have a chance to catch up to it when things go back to normal. Jessica picked Romance and Cigarettes, John Turturro's heartfelt but very odd 2005 musical starring James Gandolfini as Nick Murder, a Queens family man whose comfortable working-class life turns into a raging sea when his wife Kitty discovers he's been cheating on her with the much younger Tula. Susan Sarandon plays Kitty, Kate Winslet is Tula, and also knocking around in there are Bobby Cannavale, Elaine Stritch, Steve Buscemi, Mandy Moore, Eddie Izzard, Mary Louise Parker, Amy Sedaris, and, because this is a musical, Christopher Walken. I mean, it's not just a musical. It's a comedy and a tragedy. Basically, it's one of the wildest, weirdest, gopher-brokiest things anyone's ever attempted, and, as you're about to discover, it mostly works. This is someone else's movie.
Well, I'm a huge John Turturro fan, and the film is irreverent, and I like irreverent odysseys myself. I kind of find that life for me hasn't been super linear, which is why I relate to films that are reverent and nonlinear, because I'm like, yeah, I kind of feel like that sometimes where it's sort of surreal, and am I going to wake up, or is this really happening, or how did I get here sort of thing. And I just thought, I think it's hilarious. I still think it's hilarious. Like, it holds to this current date from when it was made however many years ago.
It was shot in 2004, 2005, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't released until 2007 because no one would touch it.
Yeah.
Which...
it's different.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, well, we'll have already set this up in the intro so you don't have to worry about explaining it, but yeah. it's a hard sell until you see it. And then I was going over the reviews just yesterday and I realized, yeah, people either got it or they didn't. There is absolutely no middle ground on this. No one said, oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
There was a beautiful, just an argument for how ludicrously over the top it is, and because everyone is willing to go there. It's not that you ever feel that the actors are uncomfortable or the director doesn't know what he's doing. There's a language to the film, and it just, a lot of people compared it to Moulin Rouge, which makes perfect sense to me because it's movie stars singing pop songs.
Yep.
But it's also a heightened reality that just happens to be studiously working class. But, I mean, by the time Bobby Cannavale shows up, you're just like, oh, I get it. Like, I know what kind of movie this is.
You see Bobby Cannavale, you're like, okay.
Yeah.
If I didn't get it before, I've certainly got it now.
Yeah. Someone referred to him as acting from his groin, which is literally dead on.
I think that was definitely where he was living. But I saw, too, in terms of, like, the actors being comfortable and stuff, like, they were in rehearsals. They sort of navigated all that stuff before they got to set, so the actors were comfortable.
Oh, they'd have to be, right?
And you can see it. You can see that on screen, that they obviously did sort of work all of that stuff out. And, I mean, Mary Louise Parker, her first scene when she comes in, says, Dad. And just the way she says it, I mean, the way she's standing and holding herself, I'm like, she's so in character, which all of them were. And they were so committed. And it was like, it would have been so fun and freeing to do work like that that's, you know, you have an opportunity to do something totally wild and different than what we normally get to do.
Yeah, it feels like the greatest workshop project.
Yes.
Right? We're going to do this, we're going to sing these, and we're going to shoot it because why the hell not? Except that, you know, the choreography is fairly complex and the camera moves are, like, they're not simple. It's not locked down. I had seen Turturro's other films before Romance and Cigarettes played at TIFF, and we were talking before we started recording about how, you know, if you could pitch this, it's like, oh, yeah, John Turturro made a movie and the Coen brothers produced it and no one would touch it.
Yeah.
Like, no distributor would take it. And a year after this came out, they made No Country and the Oscars happened and they could do whatever they wanted.
Yep.
I mean, they always did whatever they wanted, but people would pay for it.
Well, it was interesting because I forgot that the Coen brothers had produced it.
And, me too, totally blanked on that.
And so then, you know, re-looking and stuff before coming in today and I was like, oh, my God, I forgot. And I also remember being like, you know,
yeah, it does not feel like one of
those. It doesn't feel like a Coen film, a Coen brother film. And so, and it was right before they kind of landed and then their careers became what they've become and continue to become. And I think when you read even the synopsis, like just off on a sheet or IMDb or anything. It's like, it's very simple. No way would you have ever read that synopsis and seen in your head what it was that John Turturro had in his head,
you know?
So I can see in terms of a pitch how it would be like, yeah, for sure. This sounds like fun, it's a musical, whatever, but to be as irreverent as it is, I don't think anybody knew, except for John.
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, I certainly didn't think he had it in him. When I heard what it was.
Yeah.
Really? Because he's great at displaying a sense of humor when he's working for other people, but in the work he's done himself, mm-hmm. he tends to be very self-serious as a filmmaker. Like Mac is heavy going. And it's good. It's not a bad movie, but again, I could not connect this to that. In much the same way, I suppose you couldn't connect necessarily Raising Arizona to Miller's Crossing, even though they made them right back to back with each other.
Yeah.
That's the Coens for you. And what he does, what Turturro does in Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink, those are, yeah, there is a continuity somehow that leads us to Romance and Cigarettes. You can sort of see this guy who is perfectly willing to humiliate himself on camera, go all the way if he trusts you, like Lebowski alone.
That, oh, my God.
Jesus is such a lurid, dangerous, weird, potentially career-destroying role.
Yeah.
And he makes it not just fun, but ebullient. Like, you just love watching this awful character show up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And that should have told me to trust him. And then I saw the film and was like, oh, this, not only is this not a disaster, it's actually really strangely honest and open about relationships and humanity in the shape of a giant, ridiculous, like, studio musical. It feels like it might have been produced mm-hmm. in the basement at MGM. Like, when all the real directors were off doing something else, a bunch of weirdos snuck down to the basement and made this and came out.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, even though, obviously, they had, they had money because the water shot with Kate Winslet and all that sort of stuff is not, it doesn't just happen.
Right. And it's the Esther Williams stage when everyone else has gone home.
Yeah, like, exactly. But it's just sort of, it was like, but it was also very simple and relatable in terms of who these people were and are as a family. And, you know, it was also odd that the daughters, Mary Louise Parker and the other two actors, well, Mandy Moore was one of when she was quite young, but it was like, they were clearly older than what the characters were probably written to be, but it worked because of who those actors were and what they brought to those characters.
Like, it was just, they're like sick of being teenagers.
Yeah.
You get the sense that there's this weariness about them.
Yeah.
Almost. The whole cast, you put Gandolfini and Susan Sarandon together and there's an additional, like, kind of this East Coast, not even East Coast, like, hard Brooklyn, I suppose. Like, these are people who have, even though Susan Sarandon has been a movie star since the 70s.
Well, let's be honest, one of her first breakout films was Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah.
Which was totally absurd, too.
Yeah, and she was completely willing to throw herself into it.
Yeah.
But then you think about, like, what was it, 6 years later she made Atlantic City with Louis Malle, and she is utterly real as a working class habitué of this, like, I don't even know what the right word is, but she conveys exhaustion, and so does Gandolfini, and together their pairing is just so perfect because you get this sense of a couple who have, like, they're done talking, they have nothing left to say to each other, they don't hate each other, they're not tired of each other. But their mutual exhaustion has just sort of let them drift into this stasis.
Yeah.
So when he is tempted by a ludicrous caricature of seduction, mm-hmm. and again, Kate Winslet throwing herself into that is a fully committed performance.
Oh, it would have to be with that dirty mouth.
Yeah, but she's so, well, I mean, the English swear like sailors.
That's, oh, they do. It's so fun to watch her in that role because she's having so much fun just being foul-mouthed. And, I forgot. And then you rewatching it again, and I'm like, oh, it's so, God, that would be so fun to do that. Like, how could you not have fun?
Yeah.
Playing that role with her fiery red hair and
everything being on fire all the time.
All the time when she's, oh, my God, the firefighters around her and the whole day. I mean, it's just wild fun.
Yeah. And it's, you can, I think that's what it is. You can feel the actor's liberation. We're invited to enjoy it by the film rather than being held at a remove. And you know, like, these performances aren't under glass. They're for us. They're like, when you cast Christopher Walken and you ask him to sing Delilah, this is what you get. You don't yep. want a different version. You don't want a careful movie.
No, and he's so brilliant.
He really, like, everything, I...
He's just, I'm, the way he moves and the way he embodies his characters and, like, when, you know, because he did the music video.
Weapon of Choice.
Yeah, and which video, was yeah. fabulous. And, I mean, how many times have we all watched that over and over again? But it's just, there's, like, this elegance and this grace, but yet he'll say this thing with his yeah. voice. And then, you know, and he's... He, again, he just, you get lost in watching him, as you should.
Yeah.
Because he's just so in it, as were all the actors in this.
Yeah. I mean, it really is it's kind of a reverie, almost a celebration of actors acting.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that we're cautioned not to commit to. You know, like, we're supposed to be, as an audience, we're supposed to be wary of that.
Yeah.
And to wonder, why is this meta? Is this a commentary? And I don't think it is in this case. I think Turturro just loves this so much.
It's fun. It's not. Sometimes I think we do look too hard to find something or to find a meaning, where with a film like this, it's, how did you feel? Did you enjoy it? Did you have fun? Mm-hmm. It's not that the characters don't go on a journey, especially James Gandolfini's sure. character and their relationship, Susan Sarandon and him, but it's not necessarily something where it's like we have to have this huge analogy and walk away with, like, this deeper meaning and whatever. I think that you can just literally go in and be like, I feel good. And it's okay to feel good when yeah. you watch a film sometimes. We don't always have to feel sad or angry or whatever. It's like, oh, I just, that was awesome.
Yeah, yeah, it's weird. I mean, there is no larger... I kept thinking the first time through, I kept trying to figure out if this was some sort of All That Jazz thing.
Oh,
where
yeah.
that was his point of reference. But it's not, because the stylization is totally different. And ultimately, I think the message is different. It's not that Gandolfini is a Bob Fosse, Joe Gideon, self-destructive monster who
no.
pushes himself to death.
Yeah.
He's just weak, right? He likes being in love. He likes being in lust.
Yeah.
He gets distracted, and then it's not like he pays for it. Life just catches up to him.
Yep.
And it's right there in the title. It's right there. And I was reading a couple of reviews where people thought it just, that last 20 minutes wasn't necessary. And it's like, it kind of is, though, isn't it? I mean, you need to see what ultimately becomes really important, what ultimately matters.
Yeah.
And again, the film, I'm being vague, I realize, just in case in my brain, I'm being vague just in case people haven't seen it.
Yeah.
But, again, what's the title? It's, you know.
Romance
it's
and
not
cigarettes.
It's not going to end well. Neither of these things is going to end well.
No.
And, again, he went for it. He entertains us, and then he makes us just think about it a little bit, and then he leaves us on a high somehow still. Turturro just found a way.
Yeah.
And I've never interviewed him. I think it would have been one of the first questions I would ask him ever since. It's like, wow, when did you know? When did you know you could do this?
Well, I think it's so interesting, too, that at the last shot's one of my favorites, or one of the last shots, wherein James Gandolfini's in the hospital, and he's obviously, you know, in palliative care or whatever. And Susan walks in, and she pulls out this huge knife and scares the living daylights out of him. And then they both start laughing like it's this joke that's been between them.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, well, that's their relationship right there. And I think that that's relatable. And there is a huge history. And they're friends first and foremost. Maybe they're not in love, as we talked about now, but they were.
Yeah, there's something there. There's a connection.
Is.
There's an acknowledgement.
Yeah, and then I feel like in that moment, because of that sort of secret joke, and we're let in on the secret, you know, as much as they're laughing, I'm laughing too.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So when did you first see it? Did you see it theatrically? Did you get the chance?
I didn't see it theatrically. I saw it, I think I rented it on like DVD
right.
years ago, because I was like, what is this? And I always try to find different stuff. I mean, I will watch everything and anything, and I will go back and rewatch series so I can see why they worked.
Okay.
Because I'm one of the, I don't know. I love to like sit and pick stuff apart, yeah. Not in a negative way, but just sort of like be like, well, what about that worked? Why or why didn't it work?
The engineering aspect.
Yeah.
Right? Like, how do you put this together?
Yeah. Like, could it have been saved if this was done differently? So I saw it, I don't know, a long time ago. And then I obviously rewatched it before coming in today because it had been a hot minute.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm going to guess it's been about 8 years since I've seen it.
I think it would probably be, but that's one of the films that I always tell people to watch along with Holy Motors and, you know, David Lynch films and right. et cetera, et cetera.
Well, they are so, I mean, they're so unique in their creation, in their artistry. And again, it's weird that I'm thinking about a John Turturro film in line with those films, but it's not weird because this was his one shot. Like it feels like, I've used this expression before, I'm sure, it feels like a first novel. Where you pour it all yes. in because you don't know you'll ever get the chance to do it again. And this is his third feature. So he's obviously confident in the mechanical stuff. He knows what to put the camera. He knows what he wants to do. He's made two movies.
Yeah.
And yet, this doesn't feel like either of those. It doesn't feel like anything else he's done subsequently. It's just this blast of talent in every direction. I mean, the cast as well. It's not just him. And, you know, we lost Gandolfini in 2013, I guess. And the idea that there was this tiny window where, first of all, this tiny window where James Gandolfini was a marketable lead, right, because of The Sopranos, and then that you could cast him as someone named Nick Murder.
I know.
And let us kind of in on that. And it's just like, oh, it's silly.
It is.
That's ridiculous, but it's the world that we're in. And then all of these factors lined up and that Kate Winslet was willing to do it before her full respectability period started.
Yeah.
Because she's a fascinating talent, but there was a window of 5 or 6 years where she was just chasing the Oscar, and for whatever reason, or she was plugged into prestige productions, Revolutionary Road and The Reader and all of those. And you just, after, I guess it was right after this, really, like the late 2000s, the second half of the first, do we have a name for it yet? The aughts? Do we call it
something? I don't know. I'm like...
2005 to 2009.
That time.
Yeah. Until she won the Oscar, she was really chasing very, very serious stuff. And it was to the detriment, I think, of her talent because she's good at this stuff.
Well,
she's great at comedy.
Yeah, she is. She's hilarious. But I wonder if this specific film for John Turturro was around something that was happening in his life where things felt surreal or kind of like he was, am I going to wake up from this? Or maybe it was just sort of taken loosely and then inspired by, you know, not only his life, but maybe other films and things he wanted. He was like, I just want to, because relationships can be absurd and
sure.
nonlinear. And, you know, I mean, there are some people that just kind of go steady. But for a lot of us, that's not the case.
Yeah.
And then just sort of adding all these sort of wacky elements to heighten the story. But it's like, yeah, I get it. I get that character. And I know where that character lives. And I know where that character lives and where they're coming from. And then just sort of going with it and needing to get that out of his system. And then going and doing the other films that he's done
right.
and continues to do.
Go back to the respectable.
Yeah.
Or not the respectable stuff, but the things that people expect from him.
Yeah. Well, in terms of what would be considered like a straight narrative.
Right, or a viable project,
yeah.
right? Like something you can market easily.
Yeah.
I'm always fascinated when actors direct because you get the sense that they either have been wanting to do this forever or that they just thought it would be an interesting change.
Mm-hmm.
And with Turturro, I mean, this movie doesn't come out of let's see what happens. Like this is a conscious quest
yeah.
to make this film. And you have him, he's not in the film. He's completely.
He is.
Wait, where?
He's one of the dancers. I mean, he's not in it.
That's right.
Yeah, he's one of the dancers. And I was like, I mean, I didn't recognize him. I'm like, what do you mean you were one of the dancers? But he could have been in the fireman.
Yeah.
Danced around Kate in the fire. But I mean, he could have been in a couple of things. I mean, Bobby Cannavale's son, who's now an actor, is also in the film. Which I was like, I didn't see him. You know, I saw him in Nurse Jackie.
Right.
Which he was great. But I was like, there's all these, but that's what I love too when actors make films is that they just bring all these people in and they're like, hey, friends.
Yeah.
Let's do this ensemble piece. who knows what's going to happen, but we're going to have a great time while we're doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's what you get from the performances here. Like, if they didn't trust him, this thing wouldn't work.
Yeah, no.
And
yeah, it could have gone very opposite direction.
Yeah. There, I would love to see a documentary about just not the making of the film, but the pitching process, the casting process, where it's just like, so, you know, I have this thing I want to do. And because I know enough people in the industry now that that when they're working on something really personal, and you can feel there's a tension, like there's an additional sense of risk and a reservation. And I wonder if anybody ever turned him down, if there were people he approached that he didn't get, or if everybody just jumped because, yeah, why wouldn't I? This sounds fascinating. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, something different than what I'm going out for or what I've been offered.
Yeah. I mean, Gandolfini, like, no one was giving him this. Nobody offered him the chance to do this. He was doing, The Sopranos is there and the comedy in the Mexican and stuff. Like, he's got roles that are fun for him, but this was.
The Sopranos, though, was so intense. And I think, you know, being who he was and being offered the opportunity to just sink his teeth into something so different.
Yeah.
And that alone would have been like, yeah, where do I sign? But then you've also got like Amy Sedaris.
Yeah.
In there, which, you know, I mean, her comedy and everything is, I mean, she's amazing, but a lot of it's absurd and her characters are quite big and different and in terms of personality and story.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't even recognize her until close to the end of the film that it's her because of the way that she's shot for most of the film, even though she's in yelling at Bobby Cannavale, I love you.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, wasn't she doing Strangers with Candy right around that time? Like, she would have been in 2004 or
2005. I remember seeing Strangers with Candy around that time and thinking, I mean, I love the film, but a lot of people were like, I don't understand this comedian. I'm like,
yeah,
you have to read David Sedaris's books, and then you also have to know her, and like, she's not meant, like, this is supposed to be fun, it's not.
Yeah, you cannot take this seriously.
No, not at all.
And she's good at this. I just watched the new wave of episodes of BoJack Horseman, and she's phenomenal in that as a voice actor. She's, you know, heartbreaking and funny and wry and dry and able to do all of these things. And also they keep throwing these amazing tongue twisters at her and she just knocks them down.
That's awesome.
Yeah, she's a wonderful talent. And I had completely forgotten she was in this movie. I usually refresh myself a day or two before the recording.
Yeah.
I did not have time this week for various reasons. And I thought I could get away with this because the movie is, there are chunks of the film that are burned into my memory. I remember them absolutely vividly. I'd completely forgotten Sedaris was in there. And yeah, if Turturro is visible, I can't remember it. And
he's not visible.
He's just, you think he just filled in one day?
Yeah, I think
somebody wasn't around?
Well, I mean, there are some filmmakers who like actively put themselves in their film or they're in their TV shows at least once, right? But you can, it's visible. You can see that it's them. But then there are others who I think just want to be a part of the fun. And I don't know if he filled in or if he just was like, nah, I just want to dance. I don't need to be seen. It's not about that. I just want to like be a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, he knows the steps.
He sure does.
You know, you got this extra fireman's hat. Why not throw him in there?
Yeah. Well, and I forgot that Tony Goldwyn was Susan Sarandon's first love or old love, which James Gandolfini has nightmares about. You know, he just sort of, the way that he just sort of, Tony walks into frame and stuff, and you're just like, it's just smart. It's smart and so different. Yeah. What are some of your favorite scenes that are like burned?
Pretty much anything with Winslet, just because the audacity of it. You mentioned the underwater scene, which is, again, just like, oh, we're doing this. Like, we're going for it.
Yeah.
And her scenes with Gandolfini are all just, they're musical without, before anybody starts singing, there's just this playfulness between them and this electricity that you buy, even though it's your, you know, it. What was it? A King of Queens situation where you have the like dumpy male lead, hot young romantic interest partner. Every sitcom that decade was doing it.
Yeah.
And here, you actually felt the charm. You felt the reasons they would be drawn to each other. Like, she's bigger than life. He's almost smaller than life.
Yep.
He's this big, imposing figure who just has this massive insecurity, this tiny little thing that drives him that he's going to be sad and alone. And so, yeah, he's going to big it up for her, and he's going to make sure that she's drawn to him, and he's comfortable with her and easy with her, and she just responds to that. And so many of these movies depend on relationships that are defined by what the script makes characters do.
Yeah.
You can feel the movie forcing people together. And this one, it's weirdly believable. It's an organic relationship. Even though he knows he's cheating on his wife and it's wrong, he's still, like, we're on side because she's so ridiculous that why wouldn't you want to spend time with her?
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Yeah. It's just that, I mean, their relationship sort of defines the movie for me, but there's so much else going on. There's so much more stuff. The world is bigger. Cannavale, again, just every time he shows up, you're just like, you're ridiculous, but keep going.
He is so ridiculous. It's amazing. Oh, my God.
He is. Somebody I've never been able to interview. I've never had the opportunity. And he's just someone who is so completely in control of his ludicrousness. Like, he can turn it on in any situation. He's like, I don't know how he ended up in the Ant-Man movies, but he's hysterical in those. And he's just this weird blank enthusiasm.
Yep.
For whatever's going on. And, you know, now that Marvel movies are eating everybody, it's not a surprise. But then you see this incredible performance pop up in the corner. And, you know, how do you have a scene with Paul Rudd and Judy Greer and you be the most interesting thing? Like, you make the choice to just go that tiny bit bigger, and that's what Cannavale does. He's just, like, pops in everything.
He does pop in everything. He's so, I mean, if he's in anything, then that's an automatic, yes, I want to watch and see what it is or see what he does. Because he just makes such interesting choices as a performer. That it's like, well, yeah, Cannavale's here, then I'm going too, you know? And Steve Buscemi, who plays Gandolfini's, I think, coworker and best friend or whatever, but the dialogue alone that he has, and I was like, only he does it in his way, again, where he's one of those performers where if he's in something, it's like, well, that's an immediate yes, because I want to see what he's going to do.
Yeah, he's a pleasure. He really is.
No, he really can do anything. He's one of those, he's a wild card. But I think the same for Bobby Cannavale.
Yeah.
Too. Like, he's just sort of, I mean, how many different styles and types of roles have you seen him in through the trajectory of his career thus far?
Oh, yeah.
You know? And that's what's fun when you watch performers like that who kind of can just morph into all of these different sort of people.
Yeah. I think my first experience of him was probably, the first time I was aware I was watching him anyway, was probably The Station Agent.
Oh, my Lord.
Where it's just like, this is a beautiful performance of a man who is not quite as smart as he thinks he is, or maybe more intuitive emotionally than he needs to be.
Yeah.
And that little collision of, oh, I'm going to say something helpful and not being helpful at all, and then immediately regretting it. He's just smart enough to know he said the wrong thing. That's a beautiful razor to walk, right? That's a great decision to make, that you're going to show it, that you're going to reveal it. I mean, that film is a little miracle anyway, but he was so good in that. And again, this movie is a celebration of character actors like that. It's just a moment to, you know, Christopher Walken, you know he can dance, you know you've seen it, you're kind of aware of it, but let's just leave the camera on him and give him a ridiculous Tom Jones song and just bust it out.
Well, that was also what I found interesting about the film is that it's popular songs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't original works or anything like that, and but it was songs that were also relatable, that us as the audience most likely had a relationship to already, and or at least one or two of the songs, if not all of the songs, but they at least would sound familiar to you, and so that when you heard it, you were like, you know, because it was their way of being able to express themselves when words no longer did that for them. Which I was like, there's sometimes we don't know as human beings how we want to express anything any further. There's nothing left to say. Not that we're going to break into song and dance on Bloor Street.
It wouldn't be the worst.
It wouldn't be. But in this film, that's what they're doing and that's what they can. And it helps them express themselves just a little bit more where you're like, I know what you're doing.
Yeah, and the choice of, they're not quite standards, right? We kind of know some of them. There are a couple that I don't think I'd ever heard in a movie before.
There was a couple I hadn't heard in a movie before, but I knew the songs, and then some of them were very popular songs that I was like, oh, of course.
Yeah.
Christopher Walken singing Delilah. Yeah.
But there's songs that these characters would have grown up hearing too. Like, there's a relationship to the song for the performer as well as for the character that they're the right age, sort of. And Turturro's obviously drawing on something specific in his choices. And just, Delilah instead of What's New Pussycat. Like, it's a sadder song instead of a bigger, you know, if you want a Tom Jones number, it's not always the one you go to.
Yeah, no, 100%. But and it also, if it had been that song, then we'd probably have been like, I don't know, I mean.
Yeah, that would push it in the wrong direction,
yes.
I think. Although I do want to watch Christopher Walken sing What's New Pussycat now.
Yes,
I can
exactly.
picture it pretty easily, and yeah. I want to hear his phrasing.
Exactly, with his accent.
What's new, pussycat? I can see it. His,
that was pretty good.
Oh, thank
pretty
you.
Good.
Yeah, I can do a Walken. His pauses are masterful. I mean, the story goes that he just runs through every script, highlights his dialogue, and then randomly inserts those things. I don't think that's true, though. He's just, he's a trained dancer. He's an incredible actor. He's capable of almost anything.
Yeah.
I've never seen him give a bad performance. I've seen him be misused, but he is always dead on. And again, here, it's like, well, you're going to like Elvis a lot. Okay.
Yep.
Where do I go? Where do you take that? And here he did it.
I know.
Yeah. And yet he doesn't sing Elvis.
He doesn't
sing an Elvis song.
No.
He sings Tom Jones, which maybe was a rights thing, but it works. It works so well.
Very well. I was like, you got the relationship that he and his wife had.
Yeah, and you're just giddy with it by the end of that scene.
Well, you want to be in the diner.
Yeah.
You know, throwing pancakes or whatever, I don't know,
yeah.
dancing behind him.
That's it. You
want to
be.
And doing some jazz hands.
Yeah, that's what this, exactly. The movie invites you in. It doesn't hold you back.
Yeah, well, you get to be a part of it. I mean, literally,
yeah.
You know. Well, there's some times where you feel very much like you're watching something private, but this was something that was like, no, come. Everyone's invited. Everyone gets to play.
Yeah. I was thinking about, I mean, it's a bad point of comparison because it's not a good movie, but I was thinking about Woody Allen's Everyone Says I Love You, which tries this in its way, but is so self-conscious about it and so uncomfortable with musical. I don't think Woody Allen really likes watching people emote. Everyone Says I Love You is a movie made by someone who is uncomfortable with the idea of a musical. Like, he likes them in practice, but he doesn't want to make one, really. I think his argument was that he was trying to show what a musical would look like in the real world, which is that everybody stumbles and they kind of get the lines wrong, and then it's awkward and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But it's awkward and uncomfortable, right? There's no pleasure to be had in that. And Turturro is in love with the format. He wants to make a musical. He wants to show you how much fun there is to be had in this and how much pleasure you can get, even in the sad songs, even in the down moments.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe he just loves musical and he wanted to make something that was a little bit more wacky but also relatable in terms of the relationship that Gandolfini and Sarandon have. But then it's also kind of sad that he hasn't made something similar in terms of, like, thematically or in style, because a filmmaker like David Lynch does David Lynch.
Right.
And there isn't anybody else like him. And, I mean, even in terms of the style of the acting, when you go back and you watch Twin Peaks or any of that, I mean, he was doing his own thing and creating his own thing in its entirety.
Yeah.
And Turturro did that with Romance and Cigarettes, but that's where it began and it ended.
Yeah.
But who knows? Maybe he'll like revisit and it'll be some other irreverent odyssey that we'll get to partake in.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, I'm trying to think if I've even heard him talk about it recently. There really hasn't been a lot.
I watched a radio interview with him when the film first came out, and they played the dialogue between Gandolfini and Elaine Stritch, who played Gandolfini's mom.
Right, and doesn't sing, which is so disappointing.
Yeah, and I love Elaine Stritch. And you can see how much joy making the film brought him, and the joy that he has on his face listening to the actors.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, yeah, we nailed it. We did good.
Good. It's absolutely something he should be proud of.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. It was screened in August at the IFC Center. Turturro was there, and it was his own print, which I assume is a statement of just how hard it is to see this thing on film these days. Yeah, it's such an unlikely film, and almost 15 years later, I haven't seen it in a while, but I don't think it's dated. I don't think a movie like that can date.
No, I agree.
A lot of musicals tend to be fixed in their era because of a specific style of production or a particular style of performance. You know, you think about the MGM musicals and the Fox stuff and the Rodgers and Hammerstein, they all kind of have a look to them.
Yep.
And this one is, it's a blue-collar musical that isn't beholden to any specific era. I mean, it could have taken place in the 30s. It could have taken place in the 50s. I mean, music might be different, but there's a feel to it. And like, it's about relationships and male insecurity and female desire and all of the things that never date.
Well, and a woman being able to speak freely about sex and sexuality and just like so unapologetic about it. And I think that's what makes it so fun to watch Kate Winslet is like, I mean, we don't walk around speaking like that. And to hear her and kind of go, oh my God, she just said, you know, but laugh and be like, it's just sort of, it's,
and she tosses it off too.
She
it's,
just,
like, it's not a huge statement
just,
when it happens.
Yeah. It's like magic. She's got it down. And I was like, but I wonder if Kate is kind of that quick-witted type of person too. Not, I haven't met her or anything.
I want
but
her to be.
Yeah, you want, like, you hope that she's kind of this quick-witted sort of foul-mouthed person who's like, let's get a pint.
Yeah.
The one thing that I wanted to ask John Turturro about if and when I meet him is the water scene or the water song that Kate did, because I would love to know how they filmed it and also how she was able to sing
to do the
underwater
sinking.
And like be so comfortable underwater for that period of time.
I'm assuming an earpiece, right? Like something to sink to.
Yeah.
But even then, to measure the breathing and the bubbles and it's not, I mean, there's a reason that doesn't happen very often.
I know. So I was very curious because she just looks very comfortable. And I mean, I don't know how long they had to shoot it. So how many takes they did.
Yeah.
But I mean, you don't really see any bubbles when she's singing. So I was like, what is happening? Yeah. She is in water.
Yeah. She's either just expressed it all or she's holding her breath and doing the lip syncing at the same time, which can't be comfortable.
Yes.
But looks to look comfortable. I mean, I'm sure, you know, actors do uncomfortable things all the time to appear natural. But yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, that's, if it's the way I remember it, those are some long takes.
Long takes. And also, I mean, I would think that she would have had to do some training or something to be able to breathe underwater
to
like
breathe
that.
Through it,
I mean, there's all sorts of different things nowadays, but back then, I don't know if something was accessible. So like, can she just hold her breath for a really long time, but also speak and be comfortable? Like, I don't know.
Are there divers
She's
on
a magician.
Side of the frame that we can't see?
Yeah,
I think
she wasn't really there.
Yeah, I think Kate Winslet being magic is actually the best explanation for anything in this movie. Because it is, like, she's never given a performance like it before or since. She's kind of remarkable.
Yeah.
And, I mean, so is the whole movie. It feels like this impossible gift.
Well, the daughters and their band and just singing, we're angry. Not even really making sense.
No.
I was like, this is dumb.
Bad.
It's so dumb. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it feels like teenagers in a way. It feels like,
I think they were like, supposed to be, but that's kind of the beauty. It's almost, you know, I'm not sure if Mandy Moore has done theater or the other actress. I think she has, though, and Mary Louise Parker obviously do a lot of theater. And the beauty about theater is that age is kind of non-existent. Like, you can go down, you can go up, you can kind of be whatever you want. And to be able to be of a certain age and go back to playing somebody much younger than you, you are forgiving, one, and it's easy to live in that body without apologizing or being insecure about it, as opposed to being that actual age where you're awkward and your hormones and everything are all over the place. And so I think it's very freeing to be able to be 16 or 15 or however the three daughters were supposed to be, but as adults going back down and playing.
Yeah. Well, you see people do it and it's contemptuous almost of youth and how, oh, I was an idiot. I was like, well, you didn't know you were an idiot.
Exactly.
So how do you find that?
Those feelings were very real.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, I mean, I'm always surprised there aren't more teenage musicals. I mean, High School Musical is a thing, but I mean, in terms of real musicals about being that young, because when you are that young, everything feels like you're the only person experiencing it. This is like the newest sensation that no one in the world has ever felt as bad as I do. That's, you know, so many teeny bopper songs are about that.
Well, you don't realize that you're not alone, but I also think it's part of being young that you want to feel alone.
Sure, yeah.
You know? And
yeah, leave me alone. Nobody gets me.
Exactly. And no one's ever going to understand me or see me for who I am. And it's very dramatic and funny. But as I said, the seriousness that you feel when you are that age about how you want to be seen and how you want to be, it's like, well, welcome to the party. That's how every human being wants to be seen and to be heard. And I, like, to come back to John Turturro, I mean, at that time to do the film that he did, this irreverent sort of journey, nobody had done anything like that. And not that David Lynch doesn't do his thing, but you can't really compare.
No, yeah. I mean, and they're singular, separate accomplishments.
100%. I'd say. But he was so committed to creating and telling the story and did it because maybe it was for him, because he wanted to have fun, because he wanted to create an opportunity for people that he loves to work with that was non-threatening, that was comfortable, that was chill, as opposed to going on to sets where it's stressful a lot of the time.
Sure, yeah.
And then creating something completely authentic and kind of going, well, I don't know. But at the end of the day, it comes back to, like, how do we solve this? How do we make this? Because this is what I want to do. And then following through with it. Mm-hmm. It's like
convincing people to be on board with this thing that they can't fully understand.
Yeah.
And maybe you don't even understand it until you cut it. But
it could have been something completely different too, right?
Yeah,
because write the script, then filming, because things change depending on how your day is going.
Sure.
And needing to get your day. And then you get to editing and it also morphs into something else again.
Yeah.
And so it's just sort of, but seeing it through and taking steps like that, I think is so brave and honorable to do something that is going to be a standout piece that isn't marching alongside all of the other sort of narratives that we typically see.
Yeah. You can always, or at least I have this fallback thing where I can always tell when an actor trusted the director and the director betrayed them. For whatever reason, you can always tell when a performance is, when something goes wrong and it's not the actor's, or at least I always have this gut feeling that, oh, that wasn't the actor's fault. That was you doing exactly what you were asked to do and someone else just botching it somehow.
Right.
And there are, like, if you separate out, like, Winslet's performance could have killed her career for the wrong project. Like,
yeah.
You can just, you could, it would be a meme now, it would be humiliating. And the movie makes it okay. The movie makes it not just okay, but delightful that she's doing this.
Yeah.
And the same for Sarandon, really, in a couple of scenes, and the same for Gandolfini, and just pretty much any time he starts to sing. The same for maybe Cannavale, but probably not, because he's playing such a caricature. It's delightful.
I just have this vision of him on the picnic table in that white Elvis suit.
Right. He's bulletproof. Yes. But it's a risk. It's always a risk. Every time, right? Every time someone steps in front of a camera, and that's something that, again, we don't give actors enough credit for, is like, you so badly need to do this that you put yourself in this position, or you just love doing this so much that you'll do whatever is asked for you, any of that stuff. And here you have this film, I think it have only been made by an actor, like someone who is predominantly, primarily a performer, because he gets the rhythms and he understands what people are going to need to do, and he got them there, or he encouraged them, and this weird bauble is the result. It's just this fever dream musical fun house of emotion.
Yeah.
And meaning.
But he wanted them to not be scared to make fools of themselves.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, we do it all the time as human beings, whether we're aware of it or not. And so, again, you get to see them live in that, where we've talked about it throughout this time, where they were just so comfortable to be whatever it was that was happening and let the camera see all of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a delightful, weird musical party.
Yeah, and I wish that, you know, in the industry we would champion more filmmakers to just whatever their thing is to, like, do their thing.
Yeah.
And be like, bravo.
Yeah.
You did it.
To just go for it.
Yeah.
So to that end, is there anything of Romance and Cigarettes that you have borrowed or lifted or cited or just outright stolen in your own work?
I wouldn't say that I have stolen, but it's definitely inspired me.
Okay.
For sure, as a filmmaker, especially with my film Joey that I wrote and co-directed. So, I mean, it is absurd and it's irreverent, but I also love Holy Motors and it's kind of, you know, about Joey this on her wedding day, mm-hmm. and she's having this very surreal experience where she kind of just can't seem to wake up. And so she has all these encounters with these strange people as she's trying to get to the ceremony. And the people who are in, like, these strange characters are also the wedding guests, because, like, in our dreams, people from your life show up as weird characters, and you're like, why was my dad the judge of the blah, blah, blah? So, I mean, yeah, I haven't really stolen anything, but maybe I have and I'm not aware. I don't know. I'd be fine to take ownership of it if someone was sure. like, you stole that from Totoro. I'd be like, yeah, I guess I did. I didn't realize it.
Yeah, its inspiration is different from theft, I think. And yeah, no one ever says they stole anything. Why would they? It's just not how art works, I don't think.
Well, we try to do stuff that's original, but nothing's original, right?
Sure.
At least that's what they, yeah. So, I mean, all I know is that I really love specific, like, specific filmmakers, and that definitely, I think, shows through in the film. But did I steal anything specific? No.
Yeah. I think so few people talk about Romance and Cigarettes that I half expect this is going to make it to him somehow. He will hear this.
Hi, John.
Hey, John. Keep at it. Do more. I'd love a commentary track.
Yeah.
I'd love to know. I want stories.
Yeah. No. God, and the fire. Kate with the fire. Yeah. Honestly, is
the fire and the water. Let's talk about the elements. How did you do it? Tell us.
Wait a second. We just brought up the elements.
She's kind of an elemental force, right? I mean, that character is a force of, people say force of nature, and so she's constantly contrasted with or surrounded by the elements. Is there air? She's earthy, right? So that sort of counts.
I kind of feel like the air comes in towards the end, right before James goes into the hospital.
Yeah, maybe. Well, now I need to see it again.
Oh, no.
It's not,
we just went to a new level.
Well, maybe he was waiting for us to get there all along.
Maybe. We just finally arrived. Maybe that's the way to look at it.
You're welcome, John.
Yeah. And thank you.
Yeah, oh, thank you also. I guess we should start it there.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
My thanks to Jessica Hingson, who you can see in the short film Jessica Jessica on CBC Gem, where it's streaming as part of the Canadian Reflections series. And you should also check out her video for Andrea Ramela's cover of Suzanne. That's knocking around on YouTube. Thanks also to Ingrid Hamilton. She knows what she did. You can find Jessica on Twitter at Jess_Hingson, and you can find Romance and Cigarettes on Blu-ray from Olive Films. It's also streaming on Hoopla and available for rental and purchase on iTunes. There was a DVD from Sony Pictures Home Entertainment, and that did have a commentary, but I never got one, and it's now out of print. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where in addition to my film duties, I'm hosting a podcast called Now What, where I interview Torontonians about our weird new normal of self-isolation in the time of COVID-19. You can find that on Tuesdays and Fridays in your podcatcher of choice, and of course you can find this podcast on Twitter at Simcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or this show in general, please say so. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been enjoying us. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. As I've been saying for a few weeks now, Jordan Heath Rawlings' The Big Story is absolutely essential listening, and helpful, and important. Thanks for your support, and thanks for sticking around. Stay inside, watch movies. I'll see you next week.